This is the CWRU Spotlight. I'm Barbara Snyder, president of Case Western Reserve, and I am here with Morton Mandel, who is a graduate of the class of 2013, Case Western Reserve, also recipient of an honorary degree in 2007, and just today received the Distinguished Alumni Award from our Alumni Association. In honor, Mort, of your extraordinary accomplishments, it is an exceptionally well-deserved honor, and I'm delighted that we have the opportunity to talk a little bit about your career, your time at Case Western Reserve, all the things you've done in our country, in the world, and in this beautiful setting, the Maltz Performing Arts Center. So let me start at the beginning, when you and Jack and Joe first contemplated founding what would become Premier Industrial Corporation. I understand the opportunity arose when your uncle offered to sell you his auto repair shop. You detail that in your book, and he was moving to Chicago. So what made the three of you say yes to this opportunity?
I was all of 18 years old.
You were the baby of the family, right?
Yes, I had two older brothers, Joseph at 8 years older, my brother Jack 10 years older, and my sister Miriam 12 years older. And Jack, my father had been not well for the preceding 5 or 6 years. And Jack, who was then 28, really became the man of the house. And it was his leadership. I went along. My brother Joe went along with Jack. I went along with Jack. The challenge was money. What are we going to use to buy the business? So my brother Jack asked my uncle how much he wanted. He said to my brother, see how much you can raise. So that night, between Jack mostly, Joe, some, and me, probably none, we came up with $900. And my brother Jack went to my uncle and said, all we can raise is $900. And he said, it's a deal. Now, we figured out what we might have maybe been smarter to do was say we only raised $600 because the business was worth, I don't know how much, but much more. And he took it because that was my uncle. He just wanted to have a very favorable deal.
That's an incredible story. Yeah. $900. Yes, you would have been smarter to hold back a little something to get you going in the business, but it didn't make any difference because you made it an incredible start. You know, family businesses sometimes are not so easy, but you always made it work. The three of you were close for all of their lives. You were close when you were in the business. You've been close as philanthropists. How did you manage to avoid some intra-family conflict that sometimes plague family businesses?
Well, I'll start at the end. My brothers were my two best friends. Obviously, Barbara Mandel probably is my best friend, but other than that, my brothers were my two best friends. And I mean that in the normal usage of words, you know, best friends. Each would say frequently, because it would come back to me, well, I have two wonderful brothers, or I have two smart brothers, or whatever. I think being a little more probably factual, we were very different. I think that may have been the key. Very different. My brother Jack was very cerebral, very steady, very calm. My brother Joe was not very cerebral. He was good. But very creative, and ultimately, as he got older, became an artist and a sculptor and did some beautiful sculpture, one of which is on the campus of Case Western Reserve
University.
Indeed
it is.
Very good at marketing, very good at, I think if he had been a university president, he would have been a terrific fundraiser. And it was easy for me to be a leader. It's always been easy for me in my life to kind of think through, how do we get from here to there? We each used our skill set, and we were not in competition with each other. So I think that's the answer.
That's how it worked. Oh, yeah. That's a great story. Now, what was really an auto repair shop grew into this multi-billion-dollar business.
Right.
And you must have learned some great lessons along the way. How were you able to take it from there to what it became? And what did you learn on that journey?
There were three beacons we steered by. And one was, we got this from our parents, one was respect for the individual. Values were always very important in my house. We didn't have any money, but we had values. My parents' values, I would say, the best of Western civilization. And the second was we learned at a fairly young, tender age, maybe 2 or 3 years. What happened is we bought the business in 1942. My brother Joe, who was married, either had to go into the army or into a defense plant, went into a defense plant for 4 years. I enlisted in the army. I figured if I'm going to go, I'll go. We both were, when the war was over in 1946, we both got out. He left his defense plant. I left the military. And we went back into the business, and honestly, it was a very boring business. It was just so much effort for so little, so much input for so little outcome that we spent, I would say, 6 months at lunch or whenever, say, what are we going to do about this thing? This is not a good business. The last thing we want to do is shut it down. What we want to do is change it. But what do we change it into, Mort? Yeah, right. Good question. We finally hit on a very basic fundamental principle of businesses, maybe universities. What do our customers want? What do they need? What aren't they getting? So we spent 3 months trying to make a living, and we barely did. I mean, really very, very small, modest income. We spent about 3 months asking our customers what they wanted, and we came up, the three of us, with a consensus finding. They wanted us to help them with hard-to-get automobile parts. We came in with popular parts. In a supermarket, shopping for groceries would be butter, milk, bread, eggs. And every supermarket has that, and every one of our competitors. So I would go in and call on the customer, and I'd say, do you need any spark plugs today? And he'd say to me, kid, he'd say, you're the third salesman who's been in to see me today about spark plugs. Why would I buy spark plugs from you? So I'll tell you what I did. I said, well, fine. How much are you paying for your spark plugs? This is a fake number. He'd say, 69 cents. And I'd say, well, ours are 67 cents. But if you pay 65 cents for a spark plug, and you have to pay rent and everything else, and then you sell it for 67 cents, how much is left at the end of the month? None. Little. So we would say, okay, what aren't you able to get? And we came up after a while with a list of parts that if we could find sources, it's what they wanted. So here's what happened. One of the items that we picked out was molding clips that went to hold a chrome strip on the side of your car. If you remember your cars, on your doors or on your fenders or somewhere, be a chrome strip, about 2 feet long, and it would be attached by snapping onto two little, what they call clips, about the size of your thumb, that you'd have to drill into the side of your fender, and then you would snap the chrome strip. I'm not sure this is clear. You'd have to snap your chrome strip on that. Anyway, those were called molding clips. So we bought molding clips because they were hard for garages and repair shops to find. And we went in, we each took a box marked, a small little box marked Ford, another one marked Chevrolet, and another one marked Plymouth. Those were the big cars. And we put 10 samples of each in the box. And we would go in with a very sophisticated sales presentation. We'd open this little box and say, do you need any of these? Now, this is literally exactly what happened. Do you need any of these? Now, here's what happened. They would fish around. They'd say, yeah, gosh, I could use some of these. How many come packaged in a box? Whoa. We didn't have that figured out. So we invented stuff like that. 50. Fine, I'll take a box. Write down, he'll take a box. What question, Barbara, did they almost never ask?
Did they never ask you how much?
Yes. Perfect. Good for you. We were stunned. So now the question is, if price is not a factor, how much do we charge? So let's say we paid a nickel for each one because they were small. Do we charge 6 cents? Do we charge 8 cents? Do we charge 12 cents? We played around with it. We got as high as 15 cents. We didn't get a nice smile at 15 cents. So we ended up selling them for about 11 or 12 cents. That's 100% markup.
Which is good in any language.
In about a year, no more standard automobile parts, which everybody was selling, and only specialties. And in 2 more years, we were rich. What does rich mean? I'll tell you what rich means. We had no personal bills. We had new cars, and we had $5,000 in the bank. That was rich, because the exact opposite is what we lived through most of our life. And that was the beginning of our realization that if you could, quote, find a need and fill it, end quote, man, the doors were wide open. And so we grew our automobile business, and we said, let's get into other commodities. We went into industrial parts. We just kept expanding, and my book was titled It's All About Who. And it's my belief that great institutions become great because of their quality of their leadership and remain great because they sustain and maintain that same level of leadership. And I think that's the story of all great institutions. Anyway, we learned that early on. I don't know how or why we picked that up, but we did. We didn't just hire bodies to fill a job, sales job, manager's job, what have you. And I would say by the time we were Premier Industrial Corporation on the New York Stock Exchange, making double what all our competitors were making, that's a true statement. We had, you know, out of our 8,000 people, we had 200 A's, 250 A's in all the key jobs. Well, not all, but we tried to have them in all the key jobs. We had a better management organization than any of our competitors. That was it.
And that's always it, as you detail so eloquently in
your book. And that's true of Case Western Reserve University. It's true of Temple Teferoth. It's true.
Yes. And you talk in your book about the importance of great leadership and how difficult actually it is. You said you were sort of a natural leader, but it isn't so easy. You have to make a lot of tough decisions, and you really do have to get to that team of A players, as you say in the book. And you did that. You did it not only in the business, but also in your philanthropic life. So with all the organizations you've been a part of, and there have been many, you have lived by that same philosophy. And how would you say that has affected your ability to make a difference in the organizations you care about?
Barbara, I think it's probably true that so long as I have been involved in organizations, this is clearly where I'm chairman, but even as a volunteer officer or chairman or whatever, as long as I have been personally involved, that adherence, that strict 100%, not 99% adherence to don't fill a job until you find somebody that's an A. You know, we can define A, but just let's not take the time to do that now. And just keep waiting. Because once you fill that job, you might have someone in there for 10 years before they leave for whatever reason. And that's a missed opportunity. Keep the job open. So long as I've been around, that discipline has pretty much been maintained. But I can tell you, because I've got several examples, and I won't mention the names, but I've got several examples. It's so hard to have an open job. My God, we just need somebody. We have to fill that job, and before you know it, they fill the job, hopefully with at least a B, but sometimes with a C. And so it's very, very difficult to have successors. Now, I think I have a successor in the foundation and a successor in my private bank business that gets that. And the most important value I want them to retain for the next X hundred of years, whatever, is it's all about who.
And that is so true. Anybody who's read your book will know what an A player is.
Yeah.
So we won't even have to define that. I want to talk a little bit about philanthropy because you formed your family foundation long before, in terms of career success, many people do. Many people wait until they've made a lot of money before they form a foundation. And you started giving back almost immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, really, if you look back on your life, even before you were in business, you
yes.
were doing that.
Yes.
What caused you and Jack and Joe to say, this early on, we really haven't had that much success, but we're going to start giving back. We're going to create a foundation to do this work.
I remember it vividly. This was my mother, Rose Mandel, who taught us three beacons to steer by. And the way she taught it, it was how she lived her life, Barbara. It wasn't lectures. It was who she was, how she defined herself. We inhaled it. One was respect, values. Another was, whenever you can, try to make the world a better place. It's that simple. When we had $5,000 in a bank, we didn't start our foundation when we had $10,000 in a bank. We were advised, because our business was uneven to some extent. Some years we could give more, tax deductible, more to our foundation than other years. So he said, in a good year, give more. And in a bad year, you would give less. So we had a lot of good years, and we gave more. And we just inserted into our thinking, share your wealth to make a better world. We didn't buy airplanes. I don't have an airplane today. We didn't do a lot of the luxuries that people do. We defined ourselves the same way Rose Mandel did. I mean, I know I've given money, my brothers and I have given money to Case Western Reserve University. You're going to use this against me, I know. It's done as much for me as it has for you.
Well, it has certainly made an incredible difference here in a variety of ways. And it's not just the resources. We are so proud to have your names, the Jack, Joseph, and Morton Mandel School of Applied Social Sciences, because you've lived your lives, all three of you, with the same values that Rose Mandel lived her life. So it is more than just the gifts you've given, and they've been many. It is about the way you've lived your lives and the message that communicates to the students who walk in the doors of that school every day. That's really the power of what you've given us. There's a quote from the three of you that appears frequently, including, I might add, on the campus of Case Western Reserve. It notes that you chose to invest in people with the values, ability, and passion to change the world. Tell me how you decided on that as the embodiment of your philanthropic philosophy.
That may have been the most important philanthropic-oriented decision we've ever made. While the three of us were alive, we could make gifts. But if we could turn out people who would devote their lives to improving the world, if we could turn out, say, fighters for a better world, who would go into nonprofit activities like you have. And if we could start an institution, we already have it flourishing in Israel, we will be doing it in America as well. That will be a contribution that will have virtually unlimited positive impact if it all works the way we hope it will work. So we decided that the central thrust of our philanthropy, and it is, the largest budget we have every year for philanthropy is in training people. I'm going to include myself with at your level, like us, to go into social work or government. And we give them 2 years of intellectual stretching, not technique teaching, but intellectual stretching. And they have to quit their jobs, and we pay them a stipend. And if they moonlight for money, we throw them out. So they spend 2 years with us. they are changing the world. You know, changing the world could be with a huge steam shovel excavating dirt or a teaspoon excavating dirt. There's a lot of difference. But that we feel is the best ways to invest our time, energy, and money.
Well, I've had the privilege of visiting the Mandel Leadership Institute in Israel, and it is doing remarkable work there. And it's visually a beautiful place, too, because it's filled with art done by young artists.
Student art.
And so it is a really, really special place with a really special mission. And I like to think that the Mandel School is doing its version of that work, too, right here in Cleveland, Ohio. Let's talk a little bit about education, because that has been important in your life in a variety of ways. So today you told a little bit of the story of how you came to get an undergraduate degree from Case Western Reserve beginning in 1939 and ending in 2013. But there were a number of things that happened along the way. You had to detour to the Army, and then you still, while you were serving, were taking courses. Talk a little bit about that experience and what drove you to keep doing that.
The Army is what drove me to keep doing that. None of this was voluntary. When I was in the Army, as it happened, I enlisted in the Ordnance Corps because of my parts experience. They wanted people with my kinds of experience, and they were building a new outfit, and they were advertising in the papers. I saw the ad. Ad was in the Cleveland paper. And I went down and I enlisted, and I was in this outfit. About 6 months after I was in and received basic training and advanced training, they interviewed people who had any college experience, and I had 1 year. And so they interviewed me, and they interviewed a number of people, and they moved us. This is not optional. This is not something where it's an elective. They moved us to become actually engineers. They needed engineers. This is English major, 1 year. English major, wants to write a great American novel. So they're sending me to engineering school. So I did. I went. I ended up with credit hours in chemistry and mathematics and a few other things. I was in that for almost 2.5 years, and it folded. And I went back into the Army, and I went to officer candidate school and became an officer. Then I got discharged. And I went back to what was then, I think, Western Reserve University. And I said, what do I have to do to get my degree? Because I had a lot of credits. I had over 100 credits. They said, actually, if you recall, I think we had this conversation, 16 hours of chemistry. That way, because you need a major. That would have been the closest number of hours, fewest number of hours to get my major. I thought about it, and I said, I'm not going to take 16 hours of chemistry. And I just went about my business life and volunteer life and so on. I got a phone call in 2013, probably around January, from a friend of mine. I forget her name.
I might know it.
Yeah. And you called me and said you thought maybe, because I must have discussed this with you, you thought maybe there was a way I could get my degree, and you told me what it was, and I liked it, and we did it.
But I told you that there is no such thing as an honorary bachelor's degree, not at Case Western Reserve, actually not anywhere, that it has to be earned. And I told you that you still had to do something, because at Case Western Reserve, to get an undergraduate degree, we require every student to complete a capstone project. And that requires a significant written project. And then you have to defend it in front of a panel of faculty members. So I ask you whether I said your book would count. It's all about who. And I ask whether you would be willing to come and defend your thesis in front of a panel of faculty members, which I will tell you, I was nervous when I had to call you and ask if you would be willing to do that. But I also knew there was no other way, because only faculty can approve the diploma, and the requirement, and there is an exception for no one, the requirement is that you defend your capstone project before a group of faculty. You did. What was that like? I wasn't there.
I think you might say, should we compare that to a meeting around a business matter or what have you? It was, for me, a piece of cake. I mean, I knew the answer. I wrote the book. Now, I wrote it with a writer, and he added enormous panache, but it was all me. He was very good. So, I mean, it was very, very pleasant experience for me. I just wondered what these guys, were they smart enough to know I'm authentic? And the answer was yes, that they thought I wrote the book.
They knew you had. When I called to tell you, and you told this a little bit today, when I called to tell you, well, you passed, that was good to be able to make that call. And then I said, Mort, you know, you're so esteemed in the university. You've already got an honorary doctorate. I could come down and present this degree to you in your office. You could come to campus. We could do a special small ceremony. We could have your family. Or you could come to commencement, which was coming up in May. What would you like to do? You didn't answer me right away. You said, I want to think it over. And then what did you decide?
And I decided that I would march with, sit with the students, because somebody, maybe you, said, well, you could sit on the stage with the other honorary doctorates or what have you. And I said, no, I said, and that was one of the best decisions I ever made. Barbara, I may have mentioned this to you. I had no idea what an emotional experience this would be for me. You know, I have 9 honorary degrees, honorary doctorates. I've had a lot of prestigious positions. I mean, graduating and getting a first degree, a bachelor's degree, is wonderful, but it's not earth-shaking. It was an earth-shaking experience for me. I'm not sure I fully understand it, but I have that picture of me standing on the stage waving my diploma. I have that framed. I have an exchange of letters between you and me with your picture in it, framed. I really am not wise enough to understand, you know, everything that's going on in here. But it really was, the only word I can think of is emotional.
Well, it was emotional for the audience, too, because in the only time I've ever seen this, and I've been to many commencements, you got a standing ovation from your fellow graduates, which was remarkable. We had no idea it was going to happen. They just, as one, spontaneously stood up and clapped wildly for you when you waved that diploma. So it was moving for everybody who was there, not just for you. It was really special for all of us, and we are so proud that you are a graduate of Case Western Reserve. I want to ask you one thing which ties back to your family, but also your philanthropy. When the Mandel Foundation funds a physical structure, like the one you just funded for us, the Jack Joseph and Morton Mandel School of Applied Social Sciences, the beautiful renovation that we did in the addition, you always include in the gift the development of a garden on the project site. And I would love for you to tell why you do that.
Yeah. You can tell that that's a moving question for me. You've heard me today mention my mother. And it's because my brothers and I and my sister were so grateful for being born into that family. As between some wealthy Rockefeller net worth family we could have been born into, or this one, I wouldn't for a minute trade it, because I wouldn't know what I would be getting. I know what this was. My mother was an unusual person. We're who she was. I think my brother Jack was a very successful, my sister Miriam, who was the oldest, my brother Jack, my brother Joe, and I'll include myself, were successful people, however you define successful. I think we all got a lot out of living, out of life. We all felt good about our lives. And we know, we often sat around the table And we just kept acknowledging that once a year, twice a year, when things came up. In fact, I would say no less than once a year, my brothers and I would be sitting at lunch or someplace talking about a deal that maybe was a little bit controversial. And one of my brothers would say, it would just slip out, or I would say, well, you know, Ma wouldn't like that. And we'd be stunned a little that it even came up. But that's the influence she had on us. Always do the right thing. Treat others the way you would want to be treated. And if you can, make the world a better place. We had no money, and I'm telling you, Rose Mandel found money to give away to charity. She found money to loan to neighbors who needed to buy a new dress for their daughter who was getting married. And I don't know how many times I heard my mother say, and I didn't consciously think about it, but over the years it became clear. We heard our mother say every time, Mrs. Smith, Mrs. Whatever, take the $10. I don't want to loan it to you. You'll find out what it'll pay me back. Barbara, that happened 3 or 4 times a year. Where did she get it? You know, I've told this story quite a few times. I figured out, I think, where she got it. She didn't buy herself a pair of shoes. Now, that makes me emotional. I get emotional when I talk about this. So the opportunity to have a garden in the enduring memory of Simon and Rose Mandel, I mean, that makes me feel good. Makes my brothers feel good. That's why we do it.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to do, and it also speaks volumes about not only the impact she had on you, but the way that you and your whole family have turned that into impact on millions of people, including many of them at Case Western Reserve, but far beyond us. You've taken those values and you've turned them into wonderful work all around, whether it's at the Mandel Foundation in Israel, whether it's all the work that you do here in so many places, and so many places that not as many people see. But you always have that garden to remember how it all started. And it is such a beautiful story. And I thank you so much for telling us the story of your business success and your philanthropic work and how it all started with Rose Mandel. We are so proud to have these moments with you to be able to get the word out about what you've done, because it's that important.
Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.